This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
It's been a while, right, since we last spoke. It's been a couple years.
Hey, everybody. It's Jim Mallard here. Welcome to the Mallard Report. The Mallard Report is recorded in front of a live virtual audience on the Duck Pond. Tuesday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern, live. Mallard.com. M-A-L-L-I-A-R-D.com. One more thing before we start. Let me turn it over to my friend that you may know from Ancient Aliens and Curse of Oak Island and many other things, Robert Clotworthy.
On the Mallard Report, the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed on the show are solely those of the hosts and guests and not necessarily of Evergreen Podcasts, KillerPodcast.com, sponsor or affiliate, or any other individual or group. On the Mallard Report, the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed on the show are solely those of the hosts and guests and not necessarily of Evergreen Podcasts, KillerPodcast.com, sponsor or affiliate, or any other individual or group.
Back stretcher. Yeah.
I want to welcome everybody this evening. I love this. I normally try to light a little candle before the show, just kind of set a little mood. Of course, I got the big lights on anyways, but it doesn't really matter. Just kind of right. For me to kind of stare at and get some thoughts going. And I broke the match again. I need some good matches. I don't know.
It's anyways. Not what it used to be.
Yeah, I was going to say, they're not what they used to be. Nothing is. My guest tonight is Daniel Albala. How are you doing tonight, Daniel? It's been, well, you were just saying, it's been a hot minute since we've talked.
Oh, it's got to be at least a couple of years, right, since we last spoke.
I think 2018, 2019, somewhere in there.
Well, that's true, because there was this very weird thing called the pandemic.
Yeah, it kind of sucked the life out of you, right?
Yeah, kind of like, it was like, it seems like a very strange dream that maybe Salvador Dali would have conjured up.
Yeah, so, I mean, besides scrambling for your life, I guess, I mean, how have you been?
Good. You know, staying busy, working on a couple of projects, you know, love to talk to you about later on. But overall, you're staying busy. You know, what do they say about an idle mind? Is, you know, the devil likes an idle mind. So I'm trying to stay real busy.
I was going to say, so you've been trying to find the cure for all of this. So let's talk about the current film festival, which is going on this weekend. Am I right?
No, it's coming. No. It's next weekend.
Oh, okay.
It's actually the 13th, 14th, and 15th of May.
That's why we have you here, so you can get this all squared away for everybody. So when, where, how, give me all the fun stuff here.
Well, okay, so Friday, Saturday, and Sunday will be, for those who can't attend it in person, we will have a virtual event. So virtually all the films that we'll be showing on Saturday will be actually be shown on Saturday virtually as well. This is like a really new development. We decided to go ahead and do that. In addition, Friday we got a new program and Sunday. So now for those who are in the New York City area or New Jersey, more than welcome to visit us at the Producers Club. And this is a right square in the middle of Times Square. And we'll be doing an on-site festival running from 10:30 in the morning to midnight. Almost 14 hours. And we expecting close to 20 filmmakers to be showing up. Some of them are traveling as far as from LA, Toronto. So it's an exciting period for us.
So what we've normally talked through this, but I think we owe it to our listeners again to kind of talk through this process of putting one of these together. Because it fascinates me how you come, I mean, 20 hours, I mean, what'd you just say, 10 hours of film a day for 3 days? I mean, that's a lot of submissions and going through it and making sure you get the right stuff and paired together. So how does that all come together?
Well, you know, it's almost like a right brain activity. It's almost an unconscious activity. It's reached a point where myself and my half a dozen programmers go through over 90. Actually, how many films were submitted? Close to 500 this year. So we go over each one has a batch, and we go through them. Then we, you know, meet and decide. You know, we go through the criteria, what's good, what's not, and so forth. And it becomes sort of an emerging mind phenomenon where we all agree, okay, this film really absolutely a must. this one is okay, this one is and this one absolutely not happening. So that's how we decided, and it's worked out so far, so really fine. So I'm happy with the results.
So I'm picturing a big board involved here somewhere, or maybe it's a sheet of paper where you start laying out like Friday, Saturday, Sunday, where you have, because obviously there's some theming going on and some attempts to put some things together, I'm assuming. Of course, I could be
totally... That is correct. Yes, that is correct. Generally, we break it down into themes. For instance, on Friday, we might have a block on fantasy films and sci-fi, so like family style, and then we'll have a feature. And then on Sunday, we might have humanity versus technology, or welcome to our brave new world, or visionary sci-fi, or horror sci-fi. So we have different blocks depending upon the mood that we want to evoke with each block. So the end result is to create a compelling series of shorts that people can visit and features and be very happy. We try to cover a full spectrum of themes, and within the science fiction and supernatural genre.
Yeah, it's going to be tough to do. It's like I said, I'm always fascinated to talk to you and kind of work through how you work through this, because it's a lot of work.
It sure is, but it's fun. I mean, we really enjoy it because we feel we're kind of giving back to the community, and we're helping a lot of filmmakers get their feet wet. Some of them are just straight out of college, or they just made their first film, and it's amazing. So we definitely help them out in any way we can. We're trying to look out. After all, it's called indie sci-fi, which is more of edgy, takes more chances than the kind of sci-fi you might find in, say, Netflix or Amazon or any other streaming platform.
I was going to ask about that. How is sci-fi doing as a whole? Because it seems like the superhero thing is kind of being the real thing right now. And I could be wrong about that, but
I think superhero is big with the major studios, maybe with some Netflix. But we really here we get some hardcore sci-fi. So we don't virtually none of the films, except maybe one or two trailers, really rely on any kind of superhero tropes. It's mostly original, independent sci-fi. So it's from corny, geeky, kind of screwball comedies all the way to very dark, dystopian, troubling. So we try to cover the full spectrum within the sci-fi.
You've probably got, obviously some of these have been made in the last couple of years, and I'm sure some of them were kind of put together before that and just now trying to make their appearance around the world. How has that process changed for filmmakers? I'm sure you're plugged into that whole situation as people have tried to develop these projects in the last 2 years or so.
Well, funny thing is, we at first thought right after the pandemic hit, we thought, oh my God, we're going to get hit. We're going to get slammed. We're not going to get any submissions. It's going to be a dud. But we really have not seen any change at all. In fact, this year's submissions exceeded our the last time we did in New York.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like a record number, but I couldn't recall.
Yeah, it's very odd. First year we did a sci-fi here in New York City, we got a couple hundred submissions. And this year we almost doubled that. And we're just surprising, thinking, well, we got the pandemic. But, filmmakers being the kind of very enterprising lot, they'll take chances and they've done it in a way that, I suppose, makes it easier. For example, a lot of the films are shot in distant locations in the woods or in single-family homes. So there is a lot more about control. And, if you go to film school, they'll say, look, if you want to do your first short, make sure you do it in a very simple environment, like an elevator or a phone booth or the woods. But don't try to go change locations, because that's almost – you're going to change soundscapes. You're going to change all sorts of variables. And that's not going to look good in the mix. And sure enough, I think they follow that formula very well.
I was going to say, you mentioned earlier about the Devil's Playground being an idle mind. Have you seen any really creative things coming out? I guess how's the creativity changed from before to now? Has it? Or is it close to the same?
Well, what I found is very interesting. I think the creativity is pretty... It's There's always a few gems here and that are really, wow, this is really amazing. And I think we've seen one, for instance, with the documentary, in the documentary section. One of them, for instance, an example was called Axiom, which is actually a documentary on an artist living in Paris who claims to have developed a kind of a mime machine interface that enables you to talk directly with God. Now, that's quite a mouthful there, but if you watch a documentary, after the end of the documentary, you start to believe in he's onto something. Like, it's very trippy. As for a short sci-fi, we've had some very powerful abduction. Yes, in fact, yes. I mean, there are two of my favorites in the supernatural horror are in the abduction scheme, and they're both at the festival. One of them is called Surrogate, whose writer is actually also a finalist because he's got a screenplay, and I love to see his feature. And the other one is called We Are Everywhere. They're both excellent, very, very well made, very powerful films. Like, there's that quality that comes with certain supernatural films that sends shivers down your spine. It's like, oh. And I saw it with another film called Moore's Void, extremely well acted, basically about a woman who comes to who needs to reconnect with her deceased son and ends up running into some very surprising conclusion. So overall, yes, the quality has gotten better, the cinematography, the acting. If you compare the films of today versus, say, 10 years ago, it's like night and day, you know, in terms of the cinematography, the color, the writing, directing. It's very, very, very well done.
Is that just because people have more opportunity to do it? Like, because I'm thinking YouTube videos, right? Because people have been doing those for a decade now.
Absolutely, and they'll do it there. And I think that a lot of filmmakers have access to technology, which they didn't have 10 years ago. They've probably gotten to realize that they need to get working on the writing. That's why we have a screenplay competition, too. Because screenplay is really the heart of any good film is the writing. I mean, there's so much you can do with special effects, but if you really focus on the characters, the acting, the writing, that's when you can stand to stand out from the sci-fi in the sci-fi genre. So I think the writing's gotten much better overall, and in general, I think that the pandemic probably. There are a couple of films that deal with the pandemic, and a couple of screenplays deal kind of surreptitiously. You know, there's one screenplay called the vaccine cure or vaccine dealing with vaccine. I forget now the name, but there are one screenplay dealing with vaccines and a film dealing with that. So I think the pandemic kind of like did something. It kind of it helped us, helped filmmakers certainly come with new ideas.
So give me the hard sell on the festival again before we wander off into so many different strange ideas that I have going through my head. Next weekend, New York City, what's the website? Get all that.
This is the place where you can get both the virtual tickets, live stream tickets, and the in-person. It's called New York Sci-Fi Film Fest. And I'll spell it out for you. It's New York Sci, then the dash, Fi, and then it's filmfest.com.
So now the one that caught my eye, of course, they always catch my eye in different ways, but you've got a VR, virtual reality, animation film on Sunday. Now, I've been kind of, I don't want to say dabbling, kind of paying attention to virtual reality things, but man, I've never even thought about it in film. Like, I see these kids playing games, but I've never thought about a film being filmed in it. So yes, walk me through this a little bit more.
Right, it's actually on Saturday, VR, and it's essentially a VR rendition of a short that was also submitted, a live action short by the Japanese filmmaker. It's called Kaiju Decode. It's essentially about seeing this monster interact with a young girl from 360 degrees. And I think the thing with VR is that the grammar is still in its infancy, and we've yet to be able to develop good VR that can sustain our attention and our focus for more than, say, 5, 10, 15, 10 minutes. But it's happening. So the grammar, the VR grammar is what needs to be developed. Because if you watch, and I'm sure you used, go on 3D, wear your Samsung or Oculus, after maybe 10, 15 minutes, it gets tiring. You want to pull them out. It's like, man, I need a break. So how do you get around that? So you start putting together not only 5-minute VR, but 10, 15, 20, 30-minute VR pieces. That's the key. Now, there is a film that we had a few years back on VR called I, Philip. And I think you can catch some of it on YouTube right now. That was a POV of Philip's head, or Philip K. Dick's head. For those who are not familiar, back there was a Robert Hansen Robotics, put together an animatronic version of Philip K. Dick, which they worked fairly well, but it so happens that on his way to one of the festivals, someone stole his head. So the question is, what happened to Philip K. Dick's animatronic head? So this VR picks it up from that point. Is that someone picked it up and it's almost becomes a sentient, self-conscious thinking being that looks at the world from a VR 360-degree point of view. And very interesting. So I think I was able to watch it. It's like 12 minutes long. I didn't feel tired or dizzy or anything. I was able to, because the grammar is primarily 360. It's a VR POV view. So you don't really have to be doing some fancy VR, which that's when it gets into trouble. If you're doing too much fancy VR, then after a few minutes, I find that I need to take out my goggles and or Samsung, whatever gear I'm using, and give my eyes a rest. Now, with this Kaiju Decode, you won't have that problem because it also has that 360-degree cycle, so it'd be easy to watch it. So it's like watching an anime from 360 degrees.
Yeah, I was going to say, obviously, I think that's probably where we're going to head with some of these things, right? The bigger format, the 360, the VR. I mean, I'm sure there's still going to be some, I don't want to say flat films, but what were you, traditional films.
It seems to have been derailed a little bit a few years back. We were getting a lot more VR films, like live action VR. And now we're getting them, but they're generally they're defined by other themes. So I'm not sure what's going on. I think the stumbling block is this: how do you develop a better storytelling using VR? And it's like in early 20th century live action films, 2D films, the same thing.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I mean, there's a stumbling block of having the technology to view it too.
Yeah, exactly. Not everybody's going to pop, it's going to go out and buy Oculus or Samsung. They're very cheap now, but they still don't want to. You got to download the software, and it's like a series of steps.
It's not there yet, but it's coming.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I still see VR as the wave of the future. I mean, case in point, you ever watch Lawnmower Man?
No.
This is with Pierce Brosnan. It's from the early 90s. I mean, some of the effects are a little bit corny now, but the principle behind it is about using VR to accelerate human intelligence. And it was way ahead of way before The Matrix or Johnny Mnemonic or any of these other films. So I think VR it's still in its infancy, but we'll get to a point where we'll just be wearing regular glasses, we'll be able to do VR. Or for those who want to really get a full immersion, they'll be able to wear these VR applications to either learn something or right now we're still waiting. I think we're waiting for the Steven Jobs of VR to come up with something that's very practical, very well designed, compelling, that I can just wear and feel good about it. It still feels a little clunky. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, I thought Google Glass was 10 years too early, and we're getting close to 5 years for that. So,
yeah, it'll still take a while, but it's happening. I still think VR will revolutionize how we organize experience, how so much is going to happen in VR. And it's just that we've hit a couple of, speed bumps, but that's okay. I mean, I have full confidence this is going to really be an alternative to experiencing live-action film.
And I'm curious about 360, because I think that might be the bridge that gets us there or gets us totally different. Because as I can imagine being in a theater that has me totally surrounded, walking through the woods, and then having something run up from behind us.
Exactly. You know, where we were at one point thinking of doing something with that was using something like the here in New York we got the New York planetarium. Those, yeah. You know, they have like full 360, so you could have a VR projection and someone can just sit up, and then all of a sudden, at least it won't be 360 degrees, but it'll be 180 degrees, so you're able to see the action from a 180 perspective.
Yeah, it's like I said, I think that's gotta be. I mean, these people getting these 70-inch TVs too anymore. I don't know. That seems ridiculous to me, but I mean,
Yeah, that's insane. You know, we're seeing like little movie theaters.
I seen one of those the other day. I'm like, what wall in my house do I have that I could put that? No.
Yeah. You know, one thing that we're looking to do, we're in the process of creating a, we did this as a proof of concept a few years back called the Cosmodrome, which is an interactive multimedia experience where we basically introduce a concept of the Matrix or an interior reality that exists that has been revealed to us through movies like Wizard of Oz, The Matrix, 2001. It's like, it's out there in plain sight. You just got to know where to look, you know? And so we developed it back in we did this 3 years ago. It's a multimedia stage / film / VR experience. So we're looking to bring that back at some point. Because you see, I think what people are beginning to realize that science fiction is not just entertainment. It's sort of a sneak peek into the future, you know? And I think some people might realize that ever since, I don't know, we've entered into a sci-fi reality a few years back.
Well, the sci-fi reality is the smartphone, right? Like, because, you know, you got the guy talking in his watch, James Bond, or his shoe. Now we're here. I mean, well, maybe not talking in your shoe, but definitely talking to your watch.
Well, and back in 2016, when we did our, I think on your show back then, a woman, we did a panel, and she said she was thinking of writing a book where Donald Trump becomes president. And of course, not by that time, it was already a done deal. So I said, see, this is where sci-fi catches up with reality. Well, what kind of sci-fi, since most of our experience seems to be sci-fi, what kind of sci-fi can we create now that is still as compelling as the sci-fi, say, 20, 30 years ago? Because it seems like technology is really moving very quickly. So we've seen stories like AI or time travel. These are tropes which we're really trying to move away from because they're fun, but so much has been done with that. Yeah. But there are other tropes out there that like blurring the lines between VR simulation and time travel, which we have a short kind of a comedy kind of introduces that idea. So the whole idea is how to keep science fiction cutting edge, compelling, not just another story about a pandemic, because we've seen that, we've done that, you know?
Yeah, that nobody wants to see that anymore.
No, but I mean, it's like, okay, we lived through that for 2.5 years. It was a fully immersive experience.
Yeah, nobody wants to see that. You mentioned AI, and I listened to TED Talk Daily the other day about how artificial intelligence and human intelligence, boy, this was way too smart for me, right? Because they were mixing them and how to get better results and really, really smart stuff. But you're not going to tell me that AI is going to take over the planet and kill us all, right?
No, I don't think it's ever going to get to that point. I think that one thing I've learned is that humans have an innate ability to become more like the objects of their creation. So we created robots, we become more like robots. It's not like robots are becoming more like humans. It's that we become more like robots. That is, and in the way we think, the way we organize experience, the way we talk. But I think there will always be a divide, because I think consciousness is non-computational, like Sir Roger Penrose, who is a physicist. Non-computational. Doesn't boil down to other information or algorithms. But unfortunately, we are opting for a kind of domain in our consciousness which is much more analytical, digital, and that can be duplicated by algorithms. That's what we're seeing today. So my concern is not so much AI taking over the world, is that a world run by algorithms. We're getting there. So let's say you're applying for a loan, a bank loan. That's an algorithm. And then you dispute it. I'm sorry. I can't do anything about it. It's the algorithms told you that you don't qualify. Or you're applying for a job. Algorithms. You're applying. So the human factor is becoming more irrelevant. So we might enter into an era where the whole world is run by algorithms. And who programs the algorithms are those who have a particular bent. And that's the concern of many sci-fi writers and philosophers and so on. How do we, and even Philip K. Dick, how do we retain our humanity? How do we humanize, and this is the key, humanize the process through which these algorithms, so perhaps we might want to start hiring coders who have an extensive background in the humanities. So, because coders know how to speak to each other, but to a lot of people, you know, the newest app, especially the older folks, it seems like science fiction. It's like, how do you use this? And they're very frustrated because a coder, you got to follow this thread and this thread and this thread. That's how they were trained. But how about someone who doesn't come from that background? So I think it's probably a good idea to start educating coders or our future programmers in the humanities. In philosophy, so that their approach will be a little bit more organic, not so much based upon zeros and ones in digital. But so, and this is the thing about Steve Jobs. It's like if you look at him from the, you know, Steve Jobs was known for his amazing design and introduction of popularization of the PC. Is that he was a designer and a salesman, but he had a vision that was much more Renaissance. It was more right brain. Than the people that follow suit, like Dell and so on, you know, HP. And that's why his product is loved all over the world. So I think we need to nurture those kind of talents. And I think this is where this festival hopefully can make a contribution. It's not just about, entertain me, but it's about opening the door to what's possible. I think it was Dale Carnegie who said anything that you can imagine can happen. So the science fiction is almost like the science of tomorrow, is that it opens the doors to what's possible. And also what we want to avoid too is a sneak preview into a lot of the dystopian shorts that we show are what happens if technology runs amok and then we can't control it, then how do we handle it? You know, virtual, whether it be virtual reality or AI or genetic engineering and so on. So we need to really make sure that we keep track and that we humanize the process. Technology is here to stay. There's no doubt about that, but we need to be more aware how we bring our humanity into the process so that we don't create a golem and out of control, a monster without a soul, which is goes back to with the Kabbalistic concept, the golem, the Frankenstein monster that has no soul, that is all machine. That's what essentially the systems that we created, but there's still hope, and we really need to go in and have, that's the importance of the humanities, of philosophy, of literature, of the great works, and, you know. And I often tell my filmmakers not just to watch other films, but to read good literature, whether it be classical Greek or Indian or they're all basically rehashing the same old tropes, the same old themes going back 5,000 years that deals with how do we deal with this world that's often a little bit foreign to who we are, a little strange. How do we, you know, grow and thrive in that reality? And that's why by reading these classics, we can incorporate that into science fiction. I mean, like Philip K. Dick was a huge reader of 19th century French literature. You know, so it's not just, I'm going to watch this other film so I can get ideas.
So we've kind of danced around people starting out wanting to create films. Like a couple times you've kind of mentioned one location, kind of making sure you're reading things and investigating things. So what other good things do we have for people out there who might be seeking a creative endeavor? I guess filmmaking, but this could kind of go for any creative endeavor, writing, filmmaking, whatever. I mean, it all kind of falls in that same category.
Yeah, writing and teaching are good ways to. Filmmaking is about, as you know, anyone who is a filmmaker knows that it's tough to even get your name out. It's tough to, but you do it out of the love. You do it because this is inside you. This is a message you want to give to the world. You want to share with the world. If you're just thinking just because I'm going to make money or I'm going to get a directing job, good luck. But I mean, if it comes from your heart and you're willing to put up with all the pain and suffering that comes from making a good piece of film, like anything else in life, I mean, but if it comes, then that'll be worthwhile because this is something that you have, this is a message. You know, it's been said every filmmaker has maybe two or three maximum stories, real stories to tell. Like some people have said that Francis Ford Coppola basically had, it was just The Godfather, you know, or another story, and one or two. And what he thought was his accomplishment, which was The Conversation, was eclipsed by The Godfather, which he approached it almost, well, and it's good, I like it, but it's not really what I want to do. So he made The Godfather to hopefully to make money so he can make The Conversation. The Conversation, although it was a good film, was nothing I'd like. And I think that applies a lot to filmmaking too. You know, you got to have your product, you got to have your message, but don't get married to it because something else may come along as well. And so writing, VR, the technology is just part of it, but I think how do you combine the technology with other elements where you feel you're really sharing all your, extending yourself to the rest of the world, you know? And so you want to be able to look back and say, okay, I did this, I feel good, I really got my message out, and hopefully find a tribe, quote unquote, that can appreciate what you're doing, you know? I mean, there are many platforms to which you can submit and promote your film. But at the end of the day, film can inspire. I mean, we had Ron O'Malley a few years back, who was a scientist, a professor emeritus at UConn, and he is in general relativity, and he's working on a way of sending particles back in time. And the way he got inspired was by, you know, reading The Time Machine, H.G. Wells's The Time Machine. And then shortly after the death of his father, and he wanted to build a time machine so he could go back in time to tell his father that he was going to have a heart attack and that he had to do something about it. And that's the beginning of a whole life. And so there are a lot of scientists who will tell you maybe in private that how much they were influenced by watching science fiction, you know. I know when I was very young, I remember watching The Fly. I saw the Cronenberg, but also watching the original with Vincent Price, classic. For those who are, that's a great, or The Village of the Damned, that's another great film. So these films are really, they're very suggestive of the times, they are from of the times. So that back then there was a concern about the flying saucers, about the communists and so on. Now we have a different set of, we have the fragmentation of truth. So anyone who incorporates that into this film, you know, is actually reflecting what the society is going through. It's like post-truth or many truths or no truth. So that's really the new trope, and it's chock full of possibility because people don't even know what to believe anymore, because One day, for example, you'll read an article that coffee's bad. Another day, coffee's good. Another day, coffee doesn't do anything. Another day, and it applies to everything. So
you can replace coffee with anything in it. Eggs, bacon, podcasts.
Oh, yeah. Diets, exercise. So where do we sleep? Yeah, where do we draw the line? So, but I think we all have carrying within ourselves certain inner wisdom. And regardless of who is the current guru, and we need to reconnect with that wisdom. And we really do, because that's what's going to sail us through the Scylla and Charybdis of these difficult period in history. But it's an exciting period because a lot is happening. Those who are searching can find amazing connections between all these different fields of inquiry, whether it be science, spirituality, religion, physics, philosophy. They're not that far apart, as people might think. They're actually, at the end, there are different things that connect them together. And there is where we're going to find our humanity. And it's very exciting. Science fiction is one way of, you know, of getting it out. I mean, at one point in the 1970s, when Philip K. Dick, 50s and 60s, science fiction was regarded as trash, basically. I mean, it's like, oh, yeah. But now it's regarded in works of Philip K. Dick, Arthur C. Clarke, Heinlein, up there with other, you know, quote-unquote dramatic writers. You know, well-done science fiction is not so much about traveling to other planets, but about why do we use the technology to get us out of our own selves, so, you know. So, and so the Science Fiction Festival is a good way to, like the one we're doing, it's a good way for us to, for people in general, to really open up to what's possible, you know, to reignite that sense of wonder, of possibility that exists. And I think that it's a way to, you know, getting out of the bottle, you know, we're like flies in a bottle. We open the bottle for a second, we feel that freedom. So this is a good way we can reconnect to that. And good science fiction is very inspiring. You know, like 2001, for example, or The Matrix. I mean, this has messages that transcend time, you know. And even The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the original one, you know. And then there were two other versions that came after that, two or three other versions that came after that. So that's why it's not, for me, even though we watch hundreds of films, I remember when we first started back in our first festival, you know, it's going to be 10 years with the PKD Festival, which is amazing. Yeah. One of the first film that came out was, it had Keir Dulay. It's called Henry, and anyone can watch, can catch it now on YouTube. It's lowercase h, Henry. Henry. Had Margot Kidder and Keir Dulay. It's about basically a sentient being that who's heading towards a certain destination, and then he realizes that he's just becoming aware. Just as he's becoming aware, he realizes that his spaceship is going to crash into a planet, and he's got all these memories about his mentors, and this Keir Dulay and Margot Kidder. And Margot Kidder sadly died a couple of years after that film came out. It's a short. And Keir Dulay is still around, but it's a beautiful short. It really is, Henry.
So I got a loaded question. Well, it sounds like a simple question, but it's not. Maybe it is. Maybe I'm just making more of it. When I think movies, I think everybody should go to Hollywood, right? Because that's kind of the glitz and glamour. But if somebody's in the sci-fi, where is the hub, capital, whatever phrase you want to put on that for sci-fi people?
Oh, I don't really know there is a capital anymore. I think we've seen a lot of films coming out of New York, L.A., Texas. You know, there really isn't one place. I think capital is where the talent is, or I think it's where the cities are, affordable cities where people can go out and try different things. You know, New York back in the 70s and the 80s had a lot of that, but unfortunately it's become a very expensive town to live in. But it still has that indie feel, but it's changed. You know, and so I think right now the focus is not so much in the movie, in the big look what's happening in Hollywood. I mean, it's more on at the level at the television level, the TV or streaming or cable. It's good writing there. You can find some really amazing writing. So you don't have to be, as long as you have a good product, it really doesn't matter where you are. It's nice to be in Hollywood if you want to be part of that group, but you don't necessarily have to. As long as you can find representation and get that representation into the hands of good agents that will support you. That's the key thing. I mean, there are different ways of doing it. You can write and start writing good scripts and get it into various competitions. And if you become a semi-finalist, then you start being picked up or at least noticed by talent agencies. Another way is get your film into the festival, like ours or other festivals. We all talk to each other. So, like, the films that come into our festival will probably be picked up by other festivals, you know. Another way is promoting it. I mean, just getting it out. And you've seen films like Blair Witch. Remember Blair Witch Project, you know? Something different, you know? And mixing reality and fiction. It's not quite a mockumentary, but doing something like that is a hybrid of the two. And people are always intrigued. People want to be intrigued. They want to be seduced. They want to be... It's almost like going to a stage show, you know, a stage hypnotist or a magician. And that's what film, that's where the magic of filmmaking comes in. It's like, oh, man, I didn't know that was coming. But so that's why I tell people avoid the classic tropes. Like, I'm going to do another time travel machine about I'm going to go back to the past and see if I can remarry that old girl and why I thought she wasn't, you know. It's been done a million times. So try to do something different. You know, something a little bit different. You can go back into the past, but instead of marrying her, meet somebody else. I mean, something unexpected. And that's the key thing. People, you know, people like to be surprised, you know. So I don't know. I can't really honestly say that there's any one spot. I would say is your talent, your product. Just got to make sure you're with a group of good people. So if you're in a community and you're a good filmmaking community, corroborations. Filmmaking is not just a solo. It's been said many times, a group effort. And make sure that people, I would say it's probably a good idea to get a decent producer who will be the one really promoting the film, and the director who can focus on the actual film. You know, sometimes you can't do that. Sometimes you need both. You have one person will, you know, wear many hats. But ideally is to really make sure you have key things like good sound mix. It's important. You know, one thing we notice with a lot of some of these shorts is that the sound is terrible. The visuals are great, but they don't pay enough attention to the sound. And that's one thing you learn the first thing in film school is that the sound is trumps visual. Visual, you can always explain it as a psychedelic experience. the character, but sound, nah. Something sound like people that's very disruptive. So you know, the classic axioms of just if you're gonna be a filmmaker, make sure you film in only one spot, not two or three or four. Just keep it to one location.
So I've got, since you mentioned team in there about having different people, we've got to take a shout out for Jonathan, who got us together yet again. Does great work for you and puts up with me, so I imagine he does great work for you because he puts up.
Well, absolutely. Jonathan's great. He's part of the team. He's been with us since day one. And we really would not have gone where we are if it wasn't for his amazing skill at networking and getting people together and so on. Yeah, he's great.
As I say, he deals with me, and that's always a full-time job for somebody.
Yeah, it does require a certain act to, you know, to work and talk to people and get them in the right place and you know, find them in the right place. Yeah. And so on. So yeah, I consider him as a core member, you know.
So with this wave of making things easier, is it easier for indie filmmakers to secure the money they need to make their films, or is it harder now because everybody has a good idea or has an idea?
Well, you can always make a film for next to nothing. I mean, as long as the writing is well, you don't need fancy locations or special effects. I mean, we've had films that were made for a few thousand dollars. You know, you just got to be more creative, much more improvise a lot more. In terms of getting funding, in some ways, yes. I think that this day and age, it's a good idea to get some sort of actor on your short. And this way, you're gonna definitely be noticed by other festivals. Now, we don't really pay so much attention to that. We pay attention more to the film and the product. But in general, getting an actor on board, even as a short, even as a cameo, works wonders. So, well, when budgeting, you should consider that possibility. You know, it really makes a difference. I mean, we've had a lot of features with Lance Henriksen. You know, you know him from Predator and Millennium and all these. And we've had with other actors. You know, we had a short with Rucker Hauer, with James Olmos, with Keir Dulay, Margot Kidder, had all these people. So they're there. So that's one thing. The writing is good, and really, instead of just jumping into the filmmaking, which I can understand the zeal, I think it's good to make sure your writing is the very best you can get. After you do your writing, have someone read it, maybe even send it to have it covered, get coverage, and make sure it's the very best that you can, very best, because once it got into film, it's very hard that you can say, well, we can do anything in editing, but come on, that's yeah, writing is key, and you got to be able to see it. And one thing that's available today is turn your film into a comic, into an illustrated version, like a manga or a graphic novel. There are writers out there and comic people who will do it fairly inexpensive. So you're already in a way, you're doing your storytelling, you're doing your shot by shot. That's how The Matrix got done. I mean, The Matrix, these guys had put together a storybook, shot by shot list of every single shot in The Matrix. I think you can buy it online. But they went to De Laurentiis, and they looked at it and said, yeah, this can happen. Because if you just read the script, I read the script, I can... It was hard to follow, a little bit difficult. Even after watching the movie. I still couldn't. After watching the movie, I read the script. So, but with the graphic novel, that's a good way. Because you see, if you do a graphic novel, you can always sell it, number one. You can always sell the you can sell the script. You can't really sell scripts. It's kind of hard. But a graphic novel, you get somebody to do it for you, you can always sell that. Make some money. It's also another good way to keep your audience following you. It's like every week I release another 5 pages of my graphic novel. And at the end of the day, at the end of that, we're going to actually shoot a film. So you're building your audience as you are making your film. That's the key thing, because what I see with a lot of directors, I think classic mistake, is that great films, right? Amazing. But they don't have a following. I go on their social media, on their Facebook, on their Instagram. It's next to nothing. 100 people, 50 people. And I said, this is an amazing film. They got nobody here. I'm telling you right now that I think that runs across virtually all disciplines. You need to have some kind of social media following. It doesn't have to be in the millions, but, a few thousand. Somebody, they want to look at that.
Yeah, you gotta get it up behind more than a few hundred.
Best times to get it when you're just starting out. Yeah. And one way is get a graphic artist on board. If he really likes it, he might be able to do it for free or next to nothing. And you guys work it out together. So every week you put out like 5 pages, so 10 pages. And get it out. And then you build your audience that way. And then you might be able to crowdfund that at some point. By saying, well, those who give me $100, you'll get our graphic novel and seat at our premiere when it happens, and whatever. Yeah. So it's just another product that you can then dangle in front of people so they'll give you money.
That's what you need, though, to get, keep,
I mean, and get, you know, get it out. And I think that's something even now a lot of filmmakers are not doing. They're not building that momentum, early stage momentum. And it's not that hard to do. You just one more thing you got to do. But it's, I think the filmmakers are in such a rush to make the film. And I understand. I've been guilty of that same when I was shooting and directing films. Sometimes it's a good idea to slow it down. Make sure your writing is impeccable. Your writing. Make sure that you get coverage. Coverage sometimes is as little as $50. Or you can go to a company called Stage 32. Sometimes you'll get coverage for next to nothing. And get coverage. Have your friends read it. Sign up for a writing class if you want, because they'll read it for you and they'll give you brutal coverage right there in front of you. But also send it to a professional. So that's just a script. As you're doing that, get someone, a graphic artist on board, and start cranking out 5-10 pages a week. Think about it. You'll have a whole storyboard. It's like, oh, how am I gonna? I'm gonna storyboard this. They'll storyboard it in 2 days. Well, you could spend 2 months making sure you have every that perfect angle you want. And if you have it storyboarded, like Alfred Hitchcock used to do, he used to storyboard everything. Then it's easier to shoot the film on a budget. You don't have to then, you know, go back and recut it and do more photography and so on. The third thing, make sure you get some good actors, please. Good actors. Because sometimes I see these amazing films and the acting is awful. Awful. Now, if it's going to be, it depends. If it's a screwball comedy and it's intentionally bad, well, like Ed Wood style, okay. But if you're doing some serious sci-fi, make sure you get some good actors, and they're there. They're out there. If you can, in your budget, you should also allow for a cameo from someone. You know, and it's not that hard. And it won't, you know, if you have a few thousand dollars, maybe just like 2 hours, bang, in and out. Now you got someone. So these are some of the things, the steps you take along the way. And it doesn't all have to cost you so much money. That's the bottom line. It can do it for as long as you're shooting on a good, you know, maybe a Blackmagic, I think. Was it Blackmagic camera? Or a Red. It doesn't have to run you that much. You just take one, grab one location and really run with it. That'll be easier than if you want, oh, I want to do not on the different cities too, and different seasons. And no, because then the continuity is going to kill you, you know. So these are classic mistakes that filmmakers make along the way. The sound has to be impeccable. It really has to be good. What else? And also get into festivals like ours, that, because, you know, we get into other festivals, take a look at us, you know, and they listen to them. We've seen this happen again and again, you know.
So speaking of the festival, I got two more quick. Well, I don't want to say quick questions. We've got 6 minutes left, though, so okay. I guess they kind of are. Now, speaking of the festivals, you've been doing them for 10 years now. Has there been one standout like story, something that's happened to somebody that's been there, or, you know, what I'm saying, like really made somebody pop, or you know where I'm headed?
Okay, there is a short that we actually showed at the 2018 PKD Film Festival. That is, it's called a Super Recognizer. And it's basically Super Recognizer are people that are actually hired, mostly in Europe, in England. They're able to spot people. Let's say wanted criminals. So they're able to look at a crowd, a footage, and say, that's the person. They're called Super Recognizers. So what I heard recently that that film now is being greenlit. I mean, that short was being greenlit to be a major series in Netflix.
No, oh, well, that'd be pretty good. I mean,
it's being what's that term? Not even shortlisted. I mean, I think it was greenlit. Yeah, to be. We've had other shorts, other features that have fairly. A significant distribution through various outlets.
That's good. That's good to hear, though. I don't want to say it this way, but it's the only way I can think of it. It's paying off. Like, it is showing think, positive returns for people.
Well, the key thing is that not to think that any one festival this day and age will, you know, get you where you want to go. But if you have a string of good festivals and meet people, at some point or other, you'll run into someone who will, your patron. Remember, even think about it. Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, they all had patrons. We don't know who they are. I mean, I think the Medicis were patrons, but other, most people don't even know. So you got to get someone who really believes in you, not the film, but in you. Because the film could always get better, but they think, I like it. You remind me of myself when I was your age, that kind of person. Yeah, I like your zest, your enthusiasm, unstoppable. That's what people want. And you know, that's how you're going to get the patron, plus a good product.
So the next fun one here is our film. This one comes from Germantown Runner. I'm glad to see he's up out of bed. He had some, well, health issues, so I'm glad to see him. But anyways, our film festivals, he's got generational in quotes here, or they across the board from baby boomers to Gen Z.
I think film festivals are, we see people of all ages. I mean, our festival tends to attract a slightly older crowd because of Philip K. Dick, you know. Well, we get people in their 20s as well, you know, and it's all the way to their 50s and 60s, you know. I think that the film, you know, and sooner or later, even people who were not brought up in the classic age of filmmaking, or even the post-class, you know, like the 90s, come to appreciate film. And it might happen later on in their lives, in their late 20s, where they say, wow, yeah, I want to go there. I want to see this. I want to see that. And I'm hearing more and more films where you go on YouTube, classic films, and man, these films were amazing compared to the trash that I see today. You know?
Well, because, a lot of stuff. Yeah. Because it took a lot more effort to make a film back in the day. Right? I mean,
it took a lot more effort, exactly. You know, for instance, let's take the example of Primer, which I use as a perfect example. Primer takes the classic trope of building your laboratory in your own home, right? And throws a time travel machine element. You know, people who grew up, this is Primer, of course, came out in 2004. It's about kids, you know, like they look like startup boys, like, you know, they look like Mormons, obviously, you know, white shirts, both of them wearing white shirts, and very smart, and like, yeah, they would have built a time machine, but this isn't done in someone's garage. But you see, that the idea of doing something this amazing in someone's garage is classic Americana. You know, like, it's not just doing in a startup, in a company, in a factory, in someone's garage. It yearns for those times where you could do amazing things, like a Thomas Edison or Nikola Tesla. So, you know, just the power of the imagination. So, basically, it's harder. But I don't think it's ever been that easy. I mean, I think it's harder, but I think you can also, that's why you need to go back to the writing and finding, mixing and matching different tropes that can appeal to people today. So what if, you know, if you look at what appealed, what was the exciting thing about, say, a lot of those UFO movies from 1950s, right? And versus the 70s, and what was going on. And today, one of the things that people, as I said, there are different elements, but there's always going to be something that is going to be very compelling that people will be drawn to. So if you write, as you write your science fiction film, it's a good idea for those who are, you know, starting to be, you know, filmmakers. So what is your generation yearning for? What do they see in the current culture, and express it through science fiction? What is it that's missing? You know, what are the intrinsic tensions? We all know about so much of it, but that can be translated into the domain of science fiction. The post truth world where we don't even, you know, for instance, you have fake news versus real news, the lamestream media versus old news. This, the polarization, that there is this kind of uncertainty, right? There definitely is an uncertainty. So the new generation of films will capitalize on that uncertainty.
So I've got to cut you because I got one more question, then we're going to be out of time. Favorite breakfast.
Favorite what?
Favorite breakfast food.
Favorite breakfast food?
Yeah.
Oh my god! I'm just coffee guy. It's a coffee and later in the afternoon I have scrambled eggs. Okay, there you go.
Hey, I want to thank you for joining
us. Thanks, Dan. Have a good evening, man. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you real soon.
Subscribe.
Sounds good.
Share. Okay, all bye-bye. The fun stuff. You know how to do it. I don't have to tell you. Just be ready for next week. It'll be sooner than you think.
Hi, this is comedian and writer, and let's be honest, I do a lot of things. This is Dino Tripodis, the host of Whiskey Business, the podcast not so much about whiskey as it is one with whiskey. Yes, we drink and talk about whiskey, but we do so much more with so many interesting people. For example, we talk to comedians like Greg Warren.
You know, I don't want to brag, but let's just say I can walk into a Red Lobster and get whatever. You know, I think the pause right there is probably more important than the word.
Amazing athletes like boxing champion Buster Douglas.
When a fighter's down and he's looking for his mouthpiece instead of trying to get up.
That's when I knew it was over.
Yeah, right?
And, yes, Bigfoot chasers.
Do you believe in Bigfoot? And if so, does he really eat beef jerky?
The Bigfoot thing is people have seen these, and I've seen a lot of compelling evidence about it.
It's Whiskey Business with Dino Tripodis. Join us for what we call a good conversation with a good pour. You really can't ask for much more than that, can you, people? Check us out at WhiskeyBusinessPod.com, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network.